Now, this is a mosaic from the 11th century showing Arthur, Rex Arctus, Arthur in hell, riding a goat. He was associated by the Orthodox, you might say, with demons worship. Because, you know, in the Christian and Jewish traditions, all gods of other people are demons. There is a ferocious passage in the Bible, in 2 Kings 5:15, you can read it yourselves, "I know that there is no God on all the earth but in Israel." That rejection of everybody in the world but oneself is what underlies the ferocity of the missionary work of the Christians in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th century in Europe. The gods of the Gentiles are devils. And in the name of God, you must get rid of them. And so Arthur himself is put down there. This is the part of Europe that belongs to this period of the great megalithic monuments. And this is the world, this is the underground world, you might say, of the Arthurian romances. The great caves of Lascaux and so forth are in the Pyrenees and in the southwest. So we have a tradition going back to 30,000 BC, which is operative in Europe, with a new and very important inflection in the second millennium BC. Then, during the second millennium, we have the invasion of what are known as the battle axe people. These are the Aryans. These are the Indo-Europeans. And they come smashing in as warrior people, and you have this overlay of a warrior, herding, patriarchal society on top of an earth-oriented, agricultural, mother goddess society. And they come in from north of the Black Sea into Europe. There they break up into many, many special communities. This is the central zone here in the southeast of Europe, from which the Slavs, these are all Indo-European people, and the Celts, and then later the Germans come. These are all related people, related languages. Now, this is a historical principle that you find not only in this zone, but in other zones as well. The people from an arid, relatively desert land come into the rich river valley land as conquerors. They're sturdy people. They've had a tough time. And they impose themselves on the area. But they absorb the civilization from below, and the people below absorb the language and mythology of the people. You get this marriage. Same thing, same date was happening down in this part of the world too, where you have the Semites coming in. Again, two peoples, people of the land and the people of the desert that come in as conquerors. Now, specifically for the Celts are one group of the Indo-Europeans, and the first group, 1000 BC, come in as a lumbering, heavily laden, you might say, people with their herds and families. And then in the realm of Switzerland and southern France, Latein, we have a new development, great, vigorous warrior tribes. This is from a bowl from Denmark called the Gundestrup bowl, and we begin to have a notion of the deities of these people. The deer. The deer sheds its antlers and the antlers grow again. Any animal that has this kind of a cycle becomes associated with the cosmic cycle. The deer becomes a very important symbolic animal here. Now, any deity that may show itself as an animal can also show itself as a human being. If you have a real mythological tradition, the emphasis is not on the form of the god, but on the energy of the god. And that energy can show itself in an animal form, in a human form, in the form of a rock, all kinds of forms. Here's the serpent that sheds its skin to be born again. And here is what's known as a torque. It's a golden neck piece. Gold is the color of the moon, of the sun. The serpent, the animal of the moon, there we have him. The solar torque of gold, and the serpent that sheds its skin. And the deity represents the synthesis of those two worlds. You get this in Kundalini Yoga. Also, the two nerves that go down, Ida and Pingala, represent the solar and lunar, or lunar and solar, actually. So this is one of the deities now of the Celts. The Romans come in, Caesar's Gallic Wars, 50 BC, and we have the Roman overlay now. We have the old Bronze Age, we have the new Celtic warriors, we have the Romans coming in. And this is a monument from the Roman period, probably 1st century BC or AD, in that date there. This figure, you can't see it in the picture, has antlers of a deer. It's the same god that we've just seen. In his lap is a cornucopia, and from it pours inexhaustibly the food. That's the grail. The grail is the vessel of inexhaustible vitality. It is that fountain in the center of the universe from which the energies of eternity pour into the world of time. This is the grail. It's in each of our hearts, that same energy. And here the grain comes out on which a deer and a bull are feeding. The deer is the wild animal. The bull is the domestic animal, symbolic of the lunar life. The two deities there are Roman deities, Apollo and Mercury. When Caesar went into Gaul, he in his sixth chapter of the Gallic Wars, he describes the gods of the Celts. But he gives them Roman names. This is wonderful. The Romans, and before them the Greeks, they could see that the gods of other people were the same gods they worshiped, because those gods are personifications of the energies that shape and maintain the universe. And so Caesar could go into Gaul and say, he whom you call Cernunnos, we call Pluto. When Alexander the Great went into India, 327 BC, Krishna, he recognized as a counterpart of Heracles. Indra, counterpart of Zeus. He whom you call Zeus, we call Indra. So there's no missionizing here. There's a wonderful recognition. But you could not possibly say, he whom you call Eshur, we call Yahweh. And why is that? That's because in the Celtic tribes, the desert people, the principal divinities were the tribal gods, the patrons of their tribes. And the natural gods, the gods of nature, were secondary, or not at all. Whereas in these traditions, principal deities are the deities that support the universe, and the secondary deity is the tribal patron, the one who happens to be the guardian and advisor of our particular race. It's in total contrast. One is exclusive, the other is what is called syncretic. So we're having a combination, I'm making a point here, of classical and Celtic divinities. And they all come from the same Indo-European Bronze Age background. There's a wonderful coordination taking place. And now comes this terrific picture. This is the Roman Empire. Look what it includes. Here's the whole world of the Near East. Alexander had gone through to India. King Ashoka, the great Buddhist king of the 3rd century BC, sent missionaries, Buddhist missionaries, to Cyprus, to Macedon, to Alexandria in Egypt. There was the Gnosticism of Buddhism operating here, and Hinduism. And this is underlying these symbols. These people know about it. Now, the Roman army included a lot of Persians. And the Persians were sent up to Britain to defend the bounds up there. And this whole line along the Danube, that was the Roman border, with Roman armies along there, many of them from the Orient. And then in the 5th century, the Huns from Asia come smashing in with Attila, and they hit the Ostrogoths here. And the Ostrogoths then push in this way and bump into the Visigoths, and the Visigoths into the Sarmatians and so forth, and the Roman lines couldn't hold. Rome collapses. Now, I want to deal with something here in the Pyrenees. This is a big surprise in this period. Just to the west of Lourdes is a little place called Saint-Pey. In Saint-Pey, we have this monument. Now, the date is the Roman period, 1st century A.D. And what it says is, Lexeia, the daughter of Odon, and then these initials mean, has gained merit through her vows to Artehe. This was something that was discovered about 10 years ago by a man who was at that time teaching in Santa Barbara, named Charles Musis. And what it shows is that already in the period of the Roman Europe, Arthur, Artehe, was revered as a god. He's originally a Celtic god. And the place where we find him revered is down here in the Pyrenees, a couple of miles from Lourdes. And the name Artus, Arthur, is related to Artemis, Arcturus. All of these are related to the deity, the bear. And the bear is the oldest worshipped deity in the world. We have bear shrines going back to Neanderthal times in just this part of the world from perhaps 100,000 BC. So much for the Roman Empire up to the 4th century. But then we have Constantine, who converts that whole empire into a Christian empire. Now, along the Danube, as I say, there were Persian soldiers. And the Persian myth at that time was of Mithra. And Mithra's great sacrifice was to kill the bull, which releases the energies of life to the world, the original cosmic bull. The sacrifice is the sacrifice of the container of the energy, the releaser of the energy. The contrast between the Mithraic and Christian religions, which were contemporary rivals for Roman, the Roman mind, the contrast was that in the Christian tradition, the Savior is the one that is killed. In the Mithraic, the Savior is the one that kills. Now, actually, the one killed and the sacrifice, just like the boar killing the deity, this is the same power. This is why the Christian tradition has done a mean job on Judas. He is the midwife of our salvation. The negative and the positive are two aspects of the play in the field of time of the one power. And when you read that passage in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, at the Last Supper, where Jesus says, "He to whom I give the sop will betray me." And he dips a piece of bread in the wine and hands it to Judas. Is that not an assignment of the 12? This is the one worthy to play the counter role to the sacrifice. It's a big story. So here we are. Here's the killer of the divine bull. Then we have, after Constantine, Theodosius, end of the 4th century, who declared, no religion is to exist in the Roman Empire but the Christian religion, no form of the Christian religion but that of the Byzantine throne. So then starts this exodus to the Orient of Roman and Syrian artists and so forth, to Persia, to India, a great new flowering of the Persian and Indian arts and a complete collapse of the European. This is 4th and 5th centuries. When does Europe come back? In the period we're talking about. It's quite a story. Here then is a map showing the extent of the Christian empire, the Christianization of Europe. It includes England and specifically Ireland, St. Patrick, 4th century Ireland, or 5th century rather. And now what happens? Here is the Danube, these are the German tribes, bang. Rome collapses, the invasions take place, and this is the invasion we're interested in. The Romans had to pull out of England around 450 AD to shorten their lines. They couldn't maintain themselves. That left England naked. It was like an oyster with the shell removed. There was no defense. And it was then that the Anglo-Saxons, the Danes, the people, the Frisians, the people from Denmark and Germany came pouring in. This is the period of the warrior Arthur. The earlier god is down here. Now we come to the 4th and 5th centuries AD. There is a man named Arthur who fights for the Britons, that is to say the Celtic people, against the invading English. We have the Britons, the British, and the English. Arthur, this particular Arthur, was not a king. The chroniclers of the time, Gildas and Nennius, speak of him, the chroniclers of the 7th and 8th century. He was a dux bellorum, a leader in war. He was a military man. A military man trained by the Romans who have pulled out, a native officer. When I was a student in Paris, there were a lot of Senegalese troops in Paris. These were native troops trained by the French. Arthur was such a figure in Britain. He was a native fighter trained by the Romans. And he assisted the native British kings in their battles. To him are assigned in the texts already a century and a half or two or three centuries after his death, great victories in 12 battles. 12, you've got the zodiac, you've got a sun king, he's already being identified with the god. And you know how it is. People have the names of deities or of saints. My name, Joseph, that doesn't mean I'm Joseph of Arimathea. But I might get mixed up with him in folk recollections. You know, the names coalesce. So this Artus, Dux Bellorum, becomes synthesized with the god image in the popular talk. Okay, the British lost, the English won. But the English won only in this area here. They did not go into Cornwall. They did not conquer into Wales. They did not go into Scotland. This is the area that the Romans had had also. So the old Celtic tradition is what is surviving in Ireland and in Wales and in Scotland. Do you see? I would call this the Celtic matrix. So all kinds of Celtic story is surviving there. The people from the south of England emigrated to Brittany. The Bretons are the people who left south of England to go to Brittany. And a legend grew up among them. Arthur was the great defender. He will return. He will restore us to our motherland. This is known as the Hope of the Bretons. And it's out of Brittany that much of this legendary comes. Refreshed by material, particularly from Ireland and Wales, Ireland, Wales, and Brittany. This is the land from which the Arthur cycle comes. The hope of the Bretons. There are a lot of old Celtic stuff associated with the Arthur story. In the oral tradition, what has been going on meanwhile? A whole new problem. In the 7th century AD, the rise of Islam. The Christians had been arguing, you know, what's the relationship of the Son to the Father, the Holy Ghost to the Father, the Son, and all this kind of business. Muhammad comes along and says there's no God but God, and Muhammad's the prophet, and what a relief. So with all the philosophical and theological argument annihilated with just the Satan, there's no God but God, within one century they were into France and at the gates of India. Spain, Moorish, the Moors, the battle between the Christians, the sign of the Virgin on their flag, and the Moors. And then we have 800 AD, Charles the Great, Charlemagne, uniting Europe in a Christian empire. This is the domain of Charlemagne. Listen, when you read European history, you wonder how the place survived at all. We now have the Muslims underneath, we've had the German invasions, we have the Muslims coming in, and now come the Norse, the Vikings, riding up the rivers of Europe, burning cities. This was the period, 8th, 9th, 10th centuries, when in the litany was the prayer, "From the fury of the Normans, O Lord, deliver us." Intentionally terror-inspiring, ferocity, intentionally just wild, ferocious people. 300 years of this kind of thing. The perilous Christian world really in trouble. Ireland had not been invaded by the English, by the Germanic people, and was a stand of the old Christian tradition. And this is this lovely little town called Kells. This is a tower of refuge that was built. You find them through Ireland, the towers from the 9th century. And the entrance to the tower is way up here. There's a ladder. You go in, pull the ladder up, and you are safe. It's in that period that the Book of Kells was illuminated. The Book of Kells is now in the National Library in Dublin. It's from the 9th century. Here is a stone cross from that period in northeast Ireland. And on the side of it here, we have this sign, chakra 4, 5, 6, 7 of the Kundalini, the two serpents of Eder and Pingala. So underlying this tradition that we're talking about are these esoteric traditions. This then is the domain of Charlemagne, which survives these traditions, and then splits in two, splits in three. Charles had three sons. To one, he gave the world that is now France, to the other, Germany, and to the third, Alsace-Lorraine, which has been back and forth between the two ever since. There's a very interesting thing that begins happening here. Modern languages come. The French out of the Latin, and the German out of the old Germanic. Whereas in Latin, the noun and the verb are together, you know. Amo, I love. Amas, thou lovest, and so forth. At this period, the noun begins to break away from the verb. Here's the individual again. I love. Ich liebe. And both sides, European. Here is Henry the Emperor, 9th century, late 9th and early 10th, of Germany, and at the same time in the West, William the Conqueror. So look what we have now, a new conquest of the British Isles. And here we have Pope Urban preaching the First Crusade, 1097. He preaches the First Crusade. Europe, which has been squabbling among itself, is united in one cause, going into the Near East, into save the shrines of Jerusalem from the Muslims. And with this I conclude. We get to the 11th and 12th century, The whole life of every young man had to be that of a warrior, of a knight, of a fighter. And when war is the career, then war games are the play. And so you have this whole tradition of jousting and of battle, with the young men showing off, knocking each other off their horses, and the ladies watching, you know, and they go into battle, each for his lady, wearing her sleeve and his helmet and so forth. And there's a wonderful period where a story of Guinevere with Lancelot as her lover. She wants to show her power. And she tells him, go into this jousting as a fool. Lose. Don't win. Get knocked off your horse until I give a certain sign, and then let go. So Lancelot, the knight, always does what this lady wants. He goes in and he gets knocked around, all right. And then I don't know what she did, just brushed her hair or something like that, and wow, he went to it. So this is the background of the Tristan and the Grail, this terrific, esoteric information of the images, with this apparently just superficial play going on.